everybody. I'd like to thank you, welcome you to our closing plenary session, and thank you all for staying with us on what's turned into a beautiful St. Patrick's Day. It started a little foggy this morning. It's my great pleasure to introduce Frederick. Pardon? Can I steal the microphone? I'm sorry, we only have one microphone.
It's tightly hooked to him behind them. So.
Can you hear me now? Okay. I just wanted to thank you all for coming to our closing plenary of Learning to Teach Day. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Frederick Fauvet, who is, we were just discussing, finishing his first year at McGill as the Director of the Office for Students with Disabilities. And we're just finishing the inaugural Disabilities Awareness Week at McGill. So he's certainly already having an impact on how we are viewing disabilities here at McGill. And I think one of the key things is this focus on universal design, in that what's good for some, in some cases, and in this case, is actually good for everybody. So Frederick has said probably hang on to your questions until the end. We'll have a question period then. And then just ask you, have a few wrap-up things. And for those of you who were here this morning, we do now have the clickers working, so we're going to try and ask you the questions that we had wanted you this morning. So without further ado, Frederick, and here I'll clip you back on here.
There. Okay. So first I'd like to thank Teaching Learning Services to have invited me to this session. It's my great pleasure to be here. And I'd like to welcome you to this closing session of what seems to have been a wonderful day, and also to point out that it's the last event of our Disabilities Awareness Week, which has been a great success, and I hope some of you had the chance to attend some of the talks and some of the panels. We'll just fix the sound. Okay, so some of you might wonder why is this guy here and why is he talking to us? He's not a lecturer, he's not a course lecturer. Well, I'll let you in on a little secret, is that the accessibility guy gets invited to everything. And it's quite crucial. I mean, we'll come back to this. Why do I get invited to everything? And we'll come back to this in my presentation. There has been, in the last couple of decades, a culture of referral. Like, if someone has a problem within the teaching environment, we refer them to someone else who is a specialist. Am I a specialist? Not really. And what I hope to do today is show you all that you can become specialist in your own fields. Because the aim of UD is to actually apply very common sense rules to try and widen access for all students. So hopefully we'll sort of debunk the myths and show you all that you actually have the knowledge to actually do things in your class without having to resort to a specialist in the field. One of the aims today is I'm gonna talk about some of the challenges that we have at the OSD, OSD being the Office for Students with Disabilities. And I will talk to you about why it's important for us to push the implementation of universal design. But I'd like the agenda to be much wider than this. And it's really just an allegory almost, just an illustration of why it is important for all of you to actually look at this model and ask yourself whether it may be pertinent to your own fields. Because if you look at the last 20 years of education in high school, for example, it's problems that were originally issues that were originally focused on students with learning disabilities, with behavior difficulties that have led the way for inclusive policies. In higher education, it's quite obvious that it will be the same. It will be probably issues surrounding disabilities in the widest of sense that will actually spearhead the movement and the change in our teaching practices as course lecturers or instructors. Okay, so I'm going to try and make this interactive, and we've got a few questions up, and you will be using the clickers. The first part of the talk is really to try and trigger some questioning as to how well you know the population that sits in front of you when you get a chance to TA, and actually see whether you have a full appreciation of the diversity that's already there, already in your lecture halls when you get a chance to TA. So we are going to use the OSD and our statistics, but to hopefully trigger some thoughts about those are students that come to our office, but they're also students that sit in your classrooms. Okay. So my first question is approximately how many students do you think are registered currently with the OSD at McGill? So I don't know if all of you have used clickers before. You just click your choice, choose your button and press. And I'll see when it stabilizes. Okay, I think we're on 95. Anyone else now? Seven, not yet. I'll give you a few minutes. 100, good. So there's 100 people in the room. 101, 2. Okay, that seems to be it. So up for the results. It takes a few seconds for the. So 45% of you, the majority, thinks it's 1,200, and it is 1,200. So obviously you have a good picture of what's out there. Just to give you an idea of how the statistics are changing quickly, just last year, it would have been the winter semester of last academic year, it would have been 150. And suddenly we've jumped to 1,200 students. And we'll come back to that. Being able to gauge what will happen next is an interesting question. Okay, another question for you. Of the population registered now, how many do you think have what we traditionally consider as disabilities? So what people, the mental image that people have, so mobility impairment, visual impairment, hearing impairment. What percentage do you think that represents in the population that uses our service? I'll just wait a few seconds. I think there's 5 more to vote. There we go. Okay. 103. 18%. Again, you're right. We do this with faculty members when we present a workshop, and no one ever gets it right, just by the way. So you actually have a pretty accurate picture of what's in your classrooms. So again, last year it would have been 25%. It's dropping to 18%. So the percentage of traditional disabilities has actually become, and they're stable, but in proportion to the number of students using the office, obviously the proportion is getting much, much smaller. Another question. Which disability represents the largest population of students registered at the OSD? So ADHD or ADD, we put both in the same category. Learning disability, chronic medical conditions, which could be the whole spectrum of anything from a temporary sort of broken limb to a permanent condition, or mental health. I'll let you vote on this. Okay, 1, 2, I think we'll see. Okay, well, in fact, the answer is 4, mental health. So I hope this one triggers some thoughts. It's changing widely. It's a great concern right across campuses in North America. It's obviously foreseen as being the biggest issue that disability services will have to face in the next decade. And that is growing constantly. In order, you have mental health first. Then you have the chronic medical conditions, because they obviously cover such a spectrum of issues. Then attention, ADD and ADHD, and learning disability come in at the same, at about 15%. Important thing being that if you put ADD, ADHD, learning disabilities, and mental health, you are now well over 50%. So in terms of diversity in your classroom, your perception of maybe a person in a wheelchair or someone you can easily identify as having a disability is long obsolete. It's now obviously the greater percentage of students that require those services and have those specific needs are not students that you can identify readily. So this should start obviously triggering some questions about your teaching practices. This is a question provided specifically for you. I wanted to see the sort of comfort level that you had. So which category do you feel the most ill-equipped, so the negative criteria, in accommodating when you're TAing? And if you've not had a chance to TA, you could just imagine, if you were actually a course lecturer, which of the disability would you find the most difficult? And it's not a judgment. We're not saying the one that you have any negative feeling for, but just in terms of tools or ideas or concept about access, which is the disability that would give you the most difficulties? It's taking longer, so obviously it's difficult to choose. So you have attention deficit, AD or ADHD, learning disabilities, medical condition, mental health, mobility impairments, or visual impairments. There's no good answer here. This is more a question for me to be able to judge what's going on out there. Okay, we got a couple more. Okay, let's see. 37%, mental health, right, okay. And that is what I sort of expected that result. Obviously, it's a challenge for everyone. It's even a challenge for our service. It's a challenge for mental health professionals. And we'll come back to this when we're looking at UD. I'll try and make this as hands-on, so you'll see that I've incorporated three activities when I'll ask you to talk to a person sitting next to you, and one of the questions will be about mental health and looking at delivery, classroom delivery, and accommodation for students with mental health issues. So I'll go back now to the sort of difficulties we had as an office and which we're facing now, and hopefully we can see whether that applies to a certain degree to your career as a lecturer or even to any situation that you may have. Because I'd like to stress today that a lot of the things we're going to discuss don't just apply to a university setting. You may be going out there to different jobs. UD is something that's starting to be applied in the workplace. You may have to deal with this with a colleague, someone you supervise in the work environment. It may be exactly the same. So UD and access is going to be an issue that you are likely to face in all arenas. So we have three challenges at USD. The first one you've seen from the statistics is the volume, this sudden explosion of numbers. Obviously, it used to be a small office, existed for about 20 years, and the old model was to say, right, if a student has an issue, the course lecturer will send them to the USD will do the work that's required to provide access. The question I ask of you is, do you think it's still feasible when you have 1,200 students on campus to carry on with this model? The CEGEPs have reported they've been hit with a first increase about 2-3 years ago. They've just been hit again this fall with yet another increase in the population of students with disabilities. And they report that unexpected figures, again, a third up, 33% in some cases up just in one semester. So this in itself should start triggering some questions in terms of you are maybe going to TA or be course instructors. And so the model of sending someone somewhere else to get the help they need may no longer be appropriate. I've also put one of the conclusions of the Fédération Collégiale Québécoise, which tells you that 1 in 10 students only they assess comes forward for services. So it might be that the numbers that we see and the explosion that we see is still the tip of the iceberg. This clientele obviously gives rise to large questions in terms of inclusion, and we'll come back to that later, but those students have also come through an educational path through a high school and CEGEP where they've been used to being accommodated in classroom. So in that respect, we also are maybe not addressing it in a way that meets the expectation in the sense that they don't necessarily want to be sent somewhere else or labeled or diagnosed. The students that have mental health issues, for example, I'm going to send an open question to all of you, but do you think it is easy for a student with mental health issues to go and request services on the basis of their mental health issues? A lot of you, a lot of students that are here with us on McGill are working towards career, towards, professional development. It's not easy to label yourself with that diagnosis. So how best to accommodate within that? I'll show you some stats that's to just back up what I just showed you in terms of explosion. So if you look at emerging clientels, which are what MELS is considering to be the new clientels in disabilities, and it's interesting and ironic because they're telling us there's a wave of students from emerging clientels coming, be ready. So I've dug for you the current statistics from last year, and I've highlighted all the ones that are classified by the Ministry of Education as being emerging clientels, and you see that already we have 59% of the students on campus that use our services that are these supposedly emerging clientels. They have long emerged, they're already here, and they already need the help. Okay, and that's one of the conclusions that's easy to reach. The second challenge, and you've seen it from the questions I've asked you, is the complexity of what we're faced with. It used to be the case that if you were a disability service provider, then you knew how to tackle issues of braille and wheelchair access. You basically could be a good disability service provider. Now the spectrum you've seen goes from anything to do with emotional, mental health issues, medical conditions, cognitive impairments, and there's no such thing anymore as a specialist who can actually address these issues. Is it even right to be addressing these issues in terms of asking a student to tell you what's wrong? Again, that's one of the questions I'm going to ask you today. Even if you wanted to, it would become difficult. But then we'll look at our third challenge, which is the inclusive and the ethics. But even from these just the strategic know-how and the competency that we bring, I have a team of 9. I would need a team of about 24 specialists to be able to actually adequately do remedial actions for each of these diagnoses or specialize them. So this is no longer possible, and I hope you see that it's becoming an obsolete model. The obsolete model was the medical model. And again, I'll repeat it, is a student goes to see a specialist, gets a diagnosis, gets documentation, and comes back to an education provider and says, I need help because of this specific diagnosis. So most higher education institutions and most workplaces are now moving to something different, which is the social model. And the social model implies that when you look at disability, you don't think this is a person who has a disability. That in fact, it's a person who has limitations and a person who has great abilities. And then you have an environment, and it might be the environment that disables that person, but not specifically, that disability is not an inherent issue with the person. Now let's take ADHD, because I like using that, that example. It's become very, very popular. There's a lot of literature. You hear a lot of people talking. You can open the newspapers every day and you'll see something about ADHD. So ADHD has become a sort of adjective. You talk about ADHD students, which is really, really irritating because there are a lot of other things in their life than just ADHD. And automatically we assume that ADHD is a disability or is a problem or is a hurdle. You know, we have a few hundred students registered with us that have ADHD, but we have a lot of other students on campus who do very, very well and are affected by ADHD. Why? Why do they not come to our office? Because some of them are very performant. Some of them are in departments and in environments that actually really draw out their strengths and their abilities. You know, an ADHD student in entrepreneurship, in advertising, when it comes to thinking outside the box, they excel. They will be the students that do better than the other students. So already you see the idea that it's not the student that has certain limitations. It's this lack of fit between an environment, an academic environment, and a student's idiosyncrasies. And in ADHD, it's very easy. So often with us, it's actually a process of saying to the student, are you sure you're in the right department? Are you sure you actually are going towards the right profession? Because they may actually be very, very proficient, very competent, and actually autonomous and need no one's help when they're in the right environment. So here you see that we're switching slowly from a medical model to a social model. And social model being that really it's a question of fitness, a fit between a student's abilities and the requirement of the institution or the department or the classroom. If I ask the question and say, what do you think the typical McGill, and it's an important question for you, McGill, some teaching style is, you know, that is on the ground in place. Is it versatile? Is it flexible? Is it, you know, focused on diversity? That's an open question. I think in some cases it will be, in some cases it won't be. But in any case, in higher education, there's no doubt that the model has always been very Victorian in the sense that someone has the knowledge, someone sits out there and doesn't have the knowledge, and we deliver them knowledge. The students sit down, the prof stands, as I'm doing today, unfortunately, and then we follow this pattern, and this pattern sort of, you know, duplicates itself and carries on. And this is maybe what we need to question, that very model is what creates the situation of disenablement. Okay? So this is when UD becomes a useful tool. And many of you today have probably come to think, what is universal design? What is it? It's really inspired by an architectural principle. Originally, it was an architectural principle invented by an architect who was disabled himself. And it's really the idea that if you build something and it's non-accessible, you will then spend a lot of time adequately equipping so that people can come in and do what they need to do in that building. It's called retrofitting. So you build something, it's non-accessible, and then you make it accessible. So if you take that image, that allegory, and you use it in an educational setting, you can see how we can apply the same thing, that if you design a curriculum or you design evaluations, but they are not accessible to everyone, you will then spend a lot of time, a lot of resources, and a lot of energy making adequate remedial action to try and allow access to a lot of students that may not be able to perform in that context. So if you compare both models, I'll let you just a minute to look at it. So we'll look at each category. The accommodation approach is what we used to do and what we've done for 20 years. So it reflects the medical approach. So the access is a problem for the individual. So that's how we say the individual has a problem of access. If you look at universal design approach, you accept the fact that it's not the student or the user that has a problem. It's the environment that creates a problem. Access is achieved through accommodation and retrofitting. So if a student can't have access, you send them somewhere else to get some extra help to make sure that they can access the classroom environment. In the new model, in the universal design model, you try and be proactive and actually create models of delivery or evaluation that are accessible from the start. Access is retroactive in the medical model, but it's proactive. We think about it ahead of time in the universal design. Access is specialized, and that's why it's been abolished in higher education, for example, when it's been accepted that an inclusive model was more appropriate socially because it brings results and outcomes in terms of social capital too. The universal design is inclusive. And the most important for me, and this is what I use as a pitch when I talk to faculty or administrators, is that access is consumable when you use the old model, whereas it's sustainable in a universal design. And what do I mean by that? I run a team of nine people that cater for 1,200 students at the moment, and the cost of running that unit is well over $1 million already. What if you get to 3,000 students within two semesters, which is what's likely to happen? What will be the cost then? So often there's a sort of misperception, oh, because we put the problem aside and someone else deals with it, it's not costly in resources. It is costly in resources. And there's a danger of creating this sort of mushroom environment where you keep sending students to a separate environment, but that environment itself is growing to such proportion that it's no longer able to actually be workable. It is time-consuming and it's resource-consuming to change curriculum and to adapt them slowly. And it's a question that we'll see at the end of the presentation. Often you will have departments say, I don't have time to do this. So it's going to take me a number of weeks in the summer, even if I stand making a dent in my methods of evaluation. Well, it's not that. We can't deny that it's time-consuming and resource-expensive. But if you look at the whole institution and the amount of time and energy and cost that we spend accommodating, retrofitting things on learning and access to learning, it's obvious that the way forward is to start looking at practices that are actually sustainable, where we make small changes, a small dance, and that those systems and those procedures can then be used over and over and over in accommodating students that have those needs. We're quickly going to go through the basic principle of universal design. Universal design has been adapted in different ways, so you'll see different models out there, and some of you have probably already heard of it in different formats or sort of metamorphosis. There's UDI, which is Universal Design for Instruction, and in university settings, usually what's the model that's adopted is Universal Design for Learning. So it's the one we're going to see today. It's based on three principles, and you have that outline as well that was distributed. So we'll go really quickly because I'd like to spend some time on the activity. But the first principle is that you provide multiple means of representation. And I've given you some examples to sort of trigger some ideas in terms of practices. So using WebCT, obviously, posting your PowerPoint slides ahead of time and your notes, background information, links, including videos, text, podcasts, recording lectures, all those things obviously are UD models, UD tools that actually will cater for that requirement. And a lot of those, obviously, available already, and teaching and learning services are spending a lot of time and energy actually making those tools available. But we also have to look at the habits and the routines that we set ourselves in. We also have to see that as course lecturer, we have to go out there and use the tools. Because the tools being there is one thing, but actually using the tools is another. The second principle is multiple means of action and expression. I've given you some examples again. Encourage different ways of expression with students, online, in class individually or as a group, social network discussions. People don't interact in the same way. And this is important here because I'm going to do a progressive slide away from disabilities. When we encourage lecturers to use these tools, they suddenly tell us, oh, well, that could be good for a second language learner. That could be good for someone who comes from a culture where they're not comfortable talking in class. But suddenly if I create a chat room online, I see that the students interact much more openly and much more willingly. So the hope today is that I show you tools and you see that the potential applications of UD go much wider than just students with disabilities. They will actually be able to cater for the needs of many, many students that are the millennium learners, that are students that are not identical to the students that were in higher education 20 years ago. And the third principle is multiple means of engagement. So this is particularly important for attention, in terms of mental health, for example, is to not be set in a format that consistently delivers in the same way. 3-hour lectures, the same format, engaging people in different ways, changing activity, using video, using different modes of engagement. Okay, so we'll use the clickers again, and I've I'm going to put up three activities, and I'd like you to take a few minutes to discuss, maybe with the person who's close to you, or if you're not sitting next to someone or you'd rather do it on your own, you can just give it some thought. And I'll give you 2 or 3 minutes. What tools would you use to accommodate the students with ADHD in class delivery? And I'll put the questions up after you've given it some thoughts. I've put a multiple choice that will sort of sum up some of the ideas, hopefully, and the themes that you'll come up with when you're discussing. Here we're not looking at evaluation. One of the questions will be on evaluation, testing, exams, quizzes, but this one is actually on class delivery. So if you have students in your class, as you probably will have or have had, that are ADHD or ADD, what changes to the delivery methods do you think would be useful to try and widen access and make the environment feel more congenial to the students? I'll give you 2 minutes to discuss with your neighbor or the person next to you, and then I'll post the multiple choice. Yeah. Okay, so I should have explained that. So it's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And within that, because we normally use the same terms for ADD, which is attention deficit disorder without the hyperactivity. So I won't give you a whole 20 minutes on the DSM-4. But basically, it's students that have either issues specific to attention or hyperactivity. So they're very kinesthetic and they need to move. Or it could be just distraction. So they can actually engage, but they lose focus. And they sort of phase out when something lasts too long or when you don't change format often enough. Okay, I'll give you 2 or 3 minutes. Try and have an active discussion, and I will post the responses, and we'll see. Yeah. What tools do you think might be useful in changing the environment of your delivery methods in class? If you have students in your class, we've seen that you do already have students with ADHD. There's a few hundred out there already. What tools could you use to change the way you deliver material? Generally in your class. Yeah, no, because the students are already in your class, so to try and obviously cater for everyone, but cater specifically for them within that environment. Generally, well, yeah, because in inclusive model you have to apply it to your class, but you're targeting that group, but you're applying it to everyone. Does that make sense? Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So it's students that have problems with distractibility, attention, retaining attention, or they can be very kinesthetic. They need to move a lot. They find it very difficult to sit in a class, for example, for 3 hours without moving. Well, it's not so much, no, it's not so much, well, some fidget, so you will have students who maybe tap their feet or they get restless, but they will need movement and they will need change. That's one of the characteristics, because they problems with impulsivity, movement, hyperactivity, or distractibility. Okay, I'm going to post up possible answers. And individually this time, you can, once you've discussed and you've come up with certain themes, see if anything there sort of actually addresses some of the tools that you discussed. So I put reduction of noise, access to and use of technology, use of stimulant medication. Stimulant medication, for those that don't know, it's Ritalin. So methamphetamines is what's given to students with ADHD because it actually stimulates them but actually enables them to focus. There's some, controversy on that, but it's one of the tools that can be used. Varied pace, frequent transition, or diversified styles of presentation. Or on the contrary, a bland, neutral mode of delivery to avoid distraction. because that's a trend as well with the ADHD. In certain contexts, people say, well, if people are too distractible or they move too much, well, if you actually make it as quiet and as, you know, calm and monotonous as possible, it will re-engage students. So I'll let you decide and I'll let you vote. If you're finding it difficult, by the way, it's a good sign, because that was the point of my coming here, to try and trigger some thoughts. You don't have to have all the answers, don't worry. ADHD, I should say, while you finish voting, is also one of the fields where you're going to see this culture of deferral that I was talking about. You see that the most. People are afraid because there's a medical model that applies to diagnosis generally, which, by the way, isn't necessarily, you know, agreed upon by everyone. Some people contest that medical model and say there's actually environmental issues that are at play in ADHD. But that medical model is very prevalent, and the drug association as well as a tool is very prevalent, which means that a lot of educators feel, as soon as the word is mentioned, that is not my problem, I can't actually tackle this. This is something for medical expert. Which really, it's a matter for educators. You know, they are sitting in a class and you need to reach them. Okay, I need about 10 more votes before we see the results. Let's go. Again, it doesn't matter what you know what comes up there. I'm not going to be shocked. It's a matter of being, you know, thought-provoking and triggering some reflection. Okay, there's two people missing, but I'll go anyway just to see what we have in terms of proportion. Okay, number four, I'm very proud of you. Thank God. Yes, because all the rest are tools, the tools that are there, but the tools that you have readily access to are changing your pace, changing your format, using technology, showing a bit of flexibility. Those are UD tools. So you see, you're starting to see a definition of universal design again. It's not a specialist sport. It's something that uses common sense. It just means that you have to sit down and think, right, I have a diverse population in front of me. What can I do to try and widen access so I can catch as many students as I can? And when you look at varied pace, frequent transition, diversified style of presentation, and I would add probably the number two to, so anyone that voted for the 10%, that was very good too. The use of technology is very important for ADHDers. First of all, because it engages them, it may actually enable them to do two things at the same time and actually allow them to maintain, stay in a class that's more or less static. But also, technology offers a lot of opportunities, a lot of ways of changing delivery, changing format, changing engagement, and playing on those three dimensions that we mentioned before. So if you combine two and four, you've got a very diversified teaching, which, by the way, we've talked about ADHD, but it's not just the ADHD population that you're reaching here. I can already tell you you're reaching the mental health issues, for example, where they will have different problems, which we will look at in a minute, but they will have issues here that this will echo, this sort of teaching will echo for them as well. So already you're catching two groups there, and you may be catching more that we're not discussing because I'm talking about disabilities, but think of others that you may be catching. If you use diversified pace, there are a lot of different learners out there who, because of their background, because of their schooling, because of the way they've been taught, their cognitive, you know, processing, are going to be engaged better if you actually use that. Okay, second activity. What, according to you, might be the accommodation required for a student with severe dyslexia to be evaluated fairly? So here we have got to focus on the evaluation method. Okay, so I'll give you a couple of minutes again to think about it. So think in terms of midterm, class quizzes, finals, the way we actually format the assessment of students' abilities within a higher education format. And take 2 minutes to talk with your. So dyslexia, for people who are not familiar with dyslexia, dyslexia is a cognitive impairment, which means that it's a neurological, which means that the transitions in the brain between, it could be in either direction. What you hear and transcribing, or what you read and what you process, or sometimes it's what you read and what you, and the way you write. All these connections that are normally straightforward, out of pattern. So a student maybe have great abilities and it's not a matter of IQ, but they may find one of this neurological sort of connection difficult. So they may not be able to understand what they're reading or they may not be able to read a text and actually follow the line, or they may actually be able to read, but they don't retain, so they can't understand what they're reading. Okay? Or it could be that when they hear things, it could be something like sensory or auditory processing issues. Then when you talk to them and there's no written support, they can't actually integrate that either. Okay? Or it could be that they have writing issues, so they actually can talk to you and perfectly form sentences and the concepts are there and the abilities are actually displayed. When it comes to writing it, they can't actually recognize the phonemes that they have to apply to actually create a word. So they function perfectly well when they're in a meeting environment or they're talking to you and in classroom, but they can't actually transfer that to long handwriting. So take 2 minutes, talk to your neighbor, and try and see what we could do. First of all, try and see what the issues are with the current assessment process, and then what could we do to try and change that. We've got one more activity. One more activity, and that's how I can wrap up in 3 minutes after that. Okay. Okay, I'll give you just 1 minute and then we'll go to the multiple choice. So I'll give you 1 minute and then I'll put up the multiple choice. Okay, I'll put up some of the possible answers and feel free to vote as you discuss. So I put providing audio support and technological support during exams. That would be, for example, having exams taped or listening to the exams or having them read by software. 2, providing a separate room for examination. 3, varying the format of evaluation within the exams, so having different parts and different format within the same exams. Or 4, providing less traditional forms of evaluation that would not always focus on writing within time constraints. So, fire away. Feel free to vote when you feel you've discussed it. I'm just going to go a little faster because I've got about 10 minutes left. I want to do the third activity and then just recap on what you've seen today. Okay, everyone could vote, and I'm just going to see the proportions, and I will do activity 3. Okay, if that's right, I'm going to show the results with the 95 that are in. That's 6. Okay, let's see. So the first one, providing audio support, technological support. The third one, varying the format of evaluation, coming in equal. And then the last one being the most popular choice. Yeah, it's great. I think the number 4 is certainly the one that's the most UD, but I'd like you to show you as well, to come back to what we were looking at, medical model versus the new social model. Providing audio support is great, but it's still a medical model in the sense that you're doing retrofitting. You're saying, right, here's the exam, and now for those who can't do this, we're going to send you somewhere else and you'll have other equipment and you'll do it a different way. So it's supportive, but just taking into consideration the fact it's still based on the old medical remedial model. Providing a separate room, that's also remedial. We do that now, but it's obviously saying it's going to be tougher, you're going to need longer time, you're going to be in a separate room. That's the old model of accommodation. The other 2 are obviously UD, because you're changing it for everyone, so you're not discriminating either, and you're actually providing an inclusive model that every student can use. And you're not focusing on student that has a disability, so you're not focusing on the issue and the impairment, you're saying there may be several impairments out there, and I'm going to do something that will probably catch several difficulties or hurdles that students could have. Combination of 3 and 4 is totally UD. So sometimes, you know, a lot of assessment here is done on multiple choice, and it's very hard to try and explain to course lecturers that there are a number of students out there who have high IQ, very high IQ, highly functioning. They understand what you're talking about. They can engage with you, but they will fail on multiple choice because it goes against their sort of cognitive makeup. They can't actually work within that format. And you'd have to be an expert on dyslexia to understand the connections. I know I've marked, I used to work in secondary, and we have multiple choice in secondary examination too. And I used to be in charge of looking at the provisions for the students. And we had to make sure and reread with them to just transcribe the fact that if they'd read the questions and chosen A, they actually had marked A. It may be silly to you, but I can tell you that 90% of our students were actually writing A, which was the right answer, and then in a grid, they were actually circling B or C. The transfer of the choice was the problem. It wasn't the knowledge. Okay, and this is where the dyslexia and the neurological issue had impact. I work with a student in secondary that has not graduated from university, and he's in the work, he has a job, and he can't recite his months from January to December. Okay, he has sequencing issue. He cannot remember things through a sequence pattern. He has a high IQ. He can function. He's got a job. He's perfectly liked by his employers. But if you ask him to do something where you actually have to remember the sequence in which things are said, he's totally unable to do that. And he will not remember. He's 25. He can't remember in which order the months come. Okay? So think of that. Also, varying patterns. You know, you have a lot of profs who are starting to do this, which is UD. When you start on your course outline, you could have option A, option B, option C. Option A could be 100% on finals. Option B could be you have a midterm which weighs this much, and you have two-term papers, and you have a final, and you know. And option C could be something different. A lot of course lecturers are already doing that, and that is, in essence, UD, in a sense that you don't have to question the students about what difficulties or hurdles they have or cognitive impairment. You're actually providing an environment that enables them to choose which format is best adequate to them. And it takes a little time to organize this, but once you've got it running, it's a habit, it's a routine, it's sustainable. You can do that every semester. It doesn't even require sort of mental energy in thinking what they need to do. You've set your format up, and then you work with that. Okay, the third activity, what hurdles do you think might impact a student's ability to perform in a course, a performance, if he or she is affected by mental health issues? We're going to do it quickly because I'm going to be asked to close, but that's your original concern, most of you, was mental health. How do we, you know, address mental health issues in the classroom? And I'm going to tell you already, maybe the discussion should have that in my multiple choice, I'll put it up. I'm going to say, which is your first concern? So it's going to be much more targeted. Don't necessarily think of tools, but think of what is the main problem that you're going to be focusing on with students who have mental health issues. So is it understanding material, management of emotions in class, attendance, interactions with peers, or interactions with instructors? Okay, so have a quick pick, and we'll see what your responses are. Because this will determine, obviously, what tools you want to start being creative about once you've identified, well, what exactly am I focusing on? And I think that's one of the issues a lot of people have, and it's probably, I would assume, why a lot of you showed concern for mental health to start with, is we don't even know what to focus on, so it's hard to find the tools that are adequate because we're not sure where to tackle this from. If you don't mind voting, and I will wrap up so I can close the session and try and do a synthesis. Got about 10 to go. Yeah. Nearly there, 95, 96, 4 more to go. Okay, we're a bit pushed for time, so I'm going to press and see what we have just in terms of general proportion. Okay, so the major concern was management of emotions in class. Well, you see from experience, and again, you're not specialists, but I can tell you from field experience what we see, the only issue which generally comes up with students who have mental health issues is attendance, is the fact that there are days when they're not right and they don't want to come to class, there are days when they're overwhelmed and they don't really want to be interacting, but it's not a problem for other people. You know, it's not an impact on peers or on course lecturer. It's simply that the student's tendency is to pull away and say, I can't really manage those things, so I actually won't attend. They want to stay engaged, they use services, they try and stay engaged, but they're not necessarily always present. So when we look at tools now, that's when hybrid teaching comes in. I don't know if you're familiar with hybrid teaching, but it's basically saying there is some face-to-face and there's some virtual teaching too. So there's some virtual platform, there's some virtual material, and we're actually combining this too. By the way, if you look at research, the millennium learner, so all of the students that you have in your class, who are post-2000, they self-identify hybrid teaching as being the way they want to be taught. When you look at the voice of students, they say, this is the format I want. Now, how much we take that into consideration in higher education is still is up for debate. But the students want, all students want to be taught like this. And if you use hybrid teaching, you're catching the students with mental health because they may be able to perform, they may be able to complete the degree, they may be able to graduate. It's just that they sometimes are going to miss certain key moments where, for their own reasons, they're not in the class. And then there's all sorts of repercussions. They don't necessarily want to explain afterward why they missed something or why they weren't engaged at that time. Chat room platform, using instant messenger, it's endless the sort of tools that you can actually use. I've actually listed quite a few up there because the other question that we get and the comment we get is, oh yes, there's all these tools, but there's not actually hard evidence about what the outcome are. There's tons of literature out there. It's just it's not permeated yet into the higher education practices. Hybrid teaching, tons of literature. I'm not really going to go through it, but I'll try and make sure that this is available for you to access. Instant matcher and live platforms in class, notes on web platforms, tons of literature on outcomes, multimedia tools, online discussions, e-portfolios, clickers, which we've used today, a lot of literature on that too, recording lectures, a sizable body as well of evidence on that, and mixed format of evaluation, which we mentioned today. So just wanted to have that slide up to tell you it's not just no man's land and we're venturing out there without outcome. There's already hard evidence of the outcome, the possible outcome, and not just for our population at the USD, but for all learners. Yes, but I'll go through this very quickly, but when we present faculty, this is some of the issues that come up. So my class is too large. I teach 200 students. I can't use UD. Well, on the contrary, it is because you have a class to 200 that you need to use UD. What do you think it's like to be a student that's sitting right at the back and sees you in this size anyway? That's when you need to have web platforms. That's when you need to have your notes up. That's when your lecture needs to be recorded. Because it could be just as pedagogically sound if they're sitting in their room watching you than if they're sitting at the back over there and there's too much noise and they can't actually hear what you're saying and they're being distracted by people around them. It works even better for large classes. We have a number of faculty members where they started organizing chat rooms where their TAs monitor the chat rooms, and that's a different form of engagement. And they don't have to do it, but they delegate those tasks. In on the ground, it means that all these students are engaging in different ways. Too time-consuming. Well, we're coming back to the argument of sustainability. It is time-consuming, but it's not as if profs or course lecturer had to do it on their own. TLS spent a lot of time and energy actually making those tools available to course lecturers and to you. We are there and we promote one-on-one assistance where we can go into faculty and actually help the implementation of tools. If a course lecturer has an idea and they've seen technology they want to use because it widens access, please do call us. If it's you or if it's a professor you're assisting, call us because we'll be more than happy to go in there and use our resources to widen access. You can see yourself that it's much, much more helpful for us to preach to someone who can actually then change the tools than to go and filter those resources into actually helping a student who's stuck in an environment that's non-compliant anyway. How can I achieve effective implementation if my department doesn't believe in it? Well, I would preach to you and say, do it, because you would be astonished how many people in education mimic practices and they mimic best practices. Even if you have resistance to start with, because you are the one that starts a procedure or starts a change, you may see colleagues who actually jump on the wagon and actually start applying the same tools. I think we're all in education because we want to see a change and we want to see engaged students. And we maybe sometimes have misconceptions about what will lead to engagement. But I think most practitioners, when they see it happen, they're enthusiastic and they jump on, even if it's discreet, but they will mimic your practices. And the students would rather go to the OSD. I hear that a lot. Well, it's like to take an historical, when blind students were forced to go to blind schools, it created a culture of blindness. And you can't take that away from people because it's the path that they were forced into. The students that are in year 3 or year 4, they were forced into a non-inclusive environment. yes, they're in a habit and they're in a routine, and that's normal, but you can change the expectations and change the habits if you actually target it through widened access. I prefer a tailored approach to my students' needs. UD is not a fit-all model. Nothing stops you from within the UD model from actually still having interactions and discourses with your students to actually see how they're doing. It's a premise that you start widening the access and then you're still free to have one-on-one relationships within that. So I think that's a misconception that happens too. The mainstream outcomes, and I'll just leave you on that, obviously everything that we've discussed today applies to mature students, second language learners, non-traditional learners or students who come back to university with different, you know, while working, students with families, it's endless. It embraces diversity, so it will actually have a positive outcome for all the students that are in your class. So I have the hope that you go away today not just remembering the guy from the USD was talking about students with disabilities. It's a great model, and it's a model that's going to be useful to you all in your careers, whatever they are, even if you're not in education. And I'll leave you on the last slide. Just to say that this transformation is huge and it's not overnight. And I have to go and, you know, spread the word everywhere. And often people say, oh, it's going to be a long process. Yes, it's going to be a long process. It's going to be a long process for us too. But it's a matter of taking the road that's sustainable and not the road that's obviously a dead end. And I hope you've at least seen that the other road is a dead end. Because just numbers, if you believe in nothing else and you don't believe in inclusion, even the management, strategic management of resources makes it impossible to carry on with the medical model. So therefore, the faster we hop into the other direction, the more effective we'll be. And just in terms of your own practice and your own future, if you are TAing at McGill, get in touch with us. We're more than happy to go into the departments and do a 45-minute workshop on UD with faculty members or with your colleagues or with graduate students if you get a group together. And we are more than happy to have contact with you on a one-on-one to try and help you change your practices. And I think, again, strategically, that's a better use of our resources. And we are developing advisors' roles where that's solely the purpose is to help faculty as opposed to just be in a room actually trying to do remedial action for exam during finals. Okay? So I thank you for your attention. And
I need to unclip you again.
You got it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's going to fall. It's going to.
This is really awkward. Thank you very much, Frederick. And in the interest of time, what we're going to do is do some of the finishing up things first, and then Frederick has indicated that he's happy to stay around afterwards and engage in conversation and discussion with people who are interested in staying. But I do want to allow people who have other places to go to get out on time and make sure that we get what we wanted. Okay, so these are the infamous questions that we tried this morning. And this just gives us a chance, a sense of who is it that attends these sessions. It helps us prepare better. It helps us know our audience. So if you could just answer, are you currently teaching or preparing to teach? So about two-thirds of you are, and a third of you are not. We're trying to find out how many people come just once a year, in which case that has implications for our programming, and how many people have came last November as well. So most of you, this is your first time this year at least. And now this leads to the next question. This is the first time that you attended LTT. In other words, if you came last year, you would say no. So for many of you, this is your first LTT, and I hope it won't be your last. And finally, we'd like to know, in terms of our own communication strategies, and if you heard about it from more than one place, where do you think was the first place or the place that had the most impact on you? Pardon? Yes. Sorry. The info bulletin is the emails that you get from skill sets.
Then very important to give you feedback. This is a question. So the info bulletin.
Okay. So that was our hunch. But it's always nice to see that where our hunches are right. And finally, as David mentioned this morning, McGill is one of the four institutions in Montreal co-hosting the annual conference for the Society for Teaching and Learning in Higher Education, which regroups people from almost all of the universities and colleges across Canada, brings together researchers national and international who are interested in many of the issues that we've been talking about. There's actually will be more than about 200 sessions over the 3 days, as well as some pre-conference workshops. And we're asking for call for volunteers, and what you get for volunteering is free access to the sessions, you know, in exchange for a modest amount of time. So if this interests you, we would encourage you to contact us. Just finally, I'd like to remind you to please fill out the evaluation forms. And on your way out, return the clickers and the forms. You will be getting an email from, it's probably already in your mailboxes, asking for feedback on the day as a whole. We take your suggestions very seriously. If you have any ideas, constructive criticism, we really value it. And also, you'll be getting the certificates of attendance for those of you who are interested in about 3 week, April 15th, so a little less than a month. And finally, I want this day like today doesn't happen without the participation of a lot of people, the facilitators who volunteer their time, our graduate education assistants who work with us at Teaching and Learning Services on a year-round basis, and the volunteers who are helping today with things like clickers and evaluation forms and registration. I'd like to really thank all of them. We couldn't make these days happen without them. And thank you all for coming. And